Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 4 years ago on August 2nd, the nation was shocked by the carnage when an Interstate Minneapolis bridge over the Mississippi River suddenly collapsed during rush hour. One of the survivors, Peter Siddons, describes the experience to NPR the next day.
I was driving, and it was stop and go because there's construction there. And at that point, I heard this roar, this rumbling, an almost explosion-like. And at the same time I heard that, the bridge started to roll and buck, and I could feel my car in the back just lift up. And I knew at that time that the bridge is collapsing.
13 people died and 98 others were seriously injured. But there was damage to our national psyche as well. The collapse signaled a deeper problem with our interstate system of bridges and roads, and they're wearing out after 50 years, and we can't afford to replace them. Journalist Zach Rosenberg wrote about that deeper problem in a June article for Car and Driver magazine. He joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Zach.
Thanks, Dan. Hi.
To our listeners, how should we pay for our roads to reverse the decline? Give us a call or email us. You can call us at 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you may have some other ideas besides just reversing the decline. How do you think we should get around in the future? 614-292-8513. Zach, in your story, you say that the interstates have so significantly affected the American landscape that our very lifestyle is unimaginable without them. That's a pretty strong statement. That's something I heard when people were talking about air conditioning in Phoenix a few weeks ago.
Certainly. Well, I think that's probably true for air conditioning and the highway system. The interstates have allowed for the growth of suburbs. You know, people spread out and live in very diverse places instead of centralizing, and that allows for people to live in various places.
But so it's, can we go backwards then if it's so significantly altered, our society? Do we have to maintain it the way it is?
Well, I think for the in the near term, yeah, certainly there is no viable alternative on the horizon. To do anything different would require centralization of a sort that I don't think many Americans would be happy to return to. The days of taking the train to work, the commuter trains are pretty much over. If you want to test this, then try cutting off a major interstate for a couple of days to a major city and see what happens.
My guest is Zach Rosenberg. He's a journalist. He wrote an article last June for the Car and Driver magazine about the state of our interstates and the decline of our interstates and the fact that we don't have the money to pay to fix them. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you want to join the conversation. Zach, you kicked off that package of stories about how we're funding or not funding our interstate system maintenance with a quick look at the Minneapolis bridge that collapsed about 4 years ago, and it forced our nation to look closely at the problems. In your estimation and in your research, did you find that anything really had changed since then?
Well, there are two fundamental issues here, one of which is a public safety issue. In that sense, not much has changed, and that's just because the threat to public safety in terms of spectacular things like the bridge collapse just aren't that big a factor. Really, the bridges, they're not going to collapse, but they are going to degrade. What was the second question?
Well, that you said there were two factors, the public safety factor and...
Sorry.
That's okay.
I lost my train of thought there.
Well, I was wondering if anything had changed since then. It forced, everybody was riveted by those images. You mentioned that states sent out special, investigators to look at bridges like that to make sure they weren't ready to blow too. But beyond that, did anything much change?
Oh, well, there's been a focus on infrastructure and specifically on transportation infrastructure that's, gained in strength since then. I wouldn't say that that's made a major difference in terms of policy. And certainly you're not seeing very many changes outside of Washington and in the states. But there is a renewed focus. You see it on there have been a plethora of reports issued that have decried sort of the collapse of American infrastructure, what is going to be coming. And while it brings focus to it, I'm not seeing any sort of practical changes, frankly.
You conclude, well, you mentioned that China is in the middle of an unprecedented infrastructure building boom. And in recent years, it's bought about 40% of the world's steel and produced half of the world's cement. And it made me wonder, is that pretty much where we were 50 years ago?
I can't say in terms of just steel and cement, but certainly the highway infrastructure is by far the largest public works program that the United States has ever built, and the most comprehensive and the most thing that changed the fabric of the country the most. China is going to be seeing something very similar, but that has to do with the rise of, there's more wealth coming in, the rise of the middle class, and you can see this if you look at, say, satellite pictures of a random part in China, a random place in China outside of a city. They're demolishing villages and putting in these gigantic roads and these huge high-speed rail networks in ways that, that certainly is China is going to change unbelievably, and soon they're going to have probably the most comprehensive transportation network on the face of the earth. In comparison to the United States, I think it can be very comparable, but they're doing it in a different way. They're focusing a lot on mass transit as well.
About 5% of our interstate bridges are now structurally deficient, you wrote, but that doesn't mean they're unsafe. So what's the difference, and how much time do we have before they could become unsafe?
That's a very good question, and frankly, I don't think anybody has the answer to that. What structurally deficient means is that it just means that there's visible wear and tear on it, which is not in itself a surprise. Some of these bridges are getting on 50, 70 years old, some of them, including some very major bridges. I wouldn't say that they're going to necessarily be unsafe just because the DOT, both state and national, are pretty much on top of the issue. And you'll see, I would expect more load postings, more bridge closings, and more work to be done on bridges in the future. And that's going to be a pain, but it's not so much a public safety issue.
Funding's the big problem. You said that the tipping point is here. A 2008 Blue Ribbon panel recommended the U.S. invest some $130 billion to maintain current levels of performance, but that amount is roughly $100 billion more than we spent that year.
Oh, yes. We spend about $32 billion a year on the highway system. That commission you're talking about, which is the National Commission on Surface Transportation and Fiscal Policy, something like that. I have it around here someplace. That's a fairly conservative estimate, I think, to maintain the status quo. And that doesn't take into account maintaining the capabilities we have so that we can increase the throughput of traffic. It doesn't take growth into account.
Can you foresee a time? Did any of the folks that you talked to foresee a time when sections of the interstate would start to be closed down? Is that even conceivable?
Well, it depends who you talk to, I guess. Conceivable, you can conceive of a lot of things, I guess. I don't think anybody realistically expects that to happen. Anytime an incident happens where an interstate is cut off, because they're so crucial, they're the main cable snaking around through, powering the economy, we'll have to restore those. And I don't think anybody's talking about shutting down an interstate or decreasing capacity on an interstate. That's just, it would be disastrous.
Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. The problem we have is that we discuss everything except the basic needs of our country, like the infrastructure and basic research. And we've got these hot-button issues, sexuality and abortion, and people just leverage these issues. And people, there seems to be we've lost something in the generation coming up, born in the late 50s and after that. We argue about tax rates. So we don't have politicians. We haven't had one probably since after Nixon or Carter, who's had the courage to say how much it costs to have a safe country. So we have one of the lowest tax rates for individuals among the wealthiest. When our country was building infrastructure, even though Kennedy gave a tax break, the tax rates between 60 and 90%. So we came to the theory that if you let the wealthiest people have all the money they want, that somehow they will be all of good character and good judgment. Well, that's failed. And so until we have politicians and educators, people who are willing to say, no, the investment bankers that make $5 million a year at a 50% tax rate, it'll never get done. The small businessman and the property owner is taxed to death. There's no more money available through the general population. We can't even make it under the present tax system.
Okay.
Our tax rate is almost 40 to 50% if you're making $80,000 to $100,000 in the state of Ohio living in the city of Columbus. So until we can have politicians who have the ability and the willingness and the public to say, if you want to do business in America mm-hmm. and make that kind of money, this is what it's going to cost.
Okay.
So until that time happens, you know, there's going to be no solution.
Okay. Fred, thanks for your call. Let's talk about the taxing structure behind, you know, our transportation system. Zach Rosenberg, the funding mechanism for highway budgets, it's stagnated.
Yes, that's the case. Right now, there is an 18.4% federal tax on the gas you buy, and that's a unit of measure, not a sales tax, so it hasn't increased. The money that comes from that sales tax goes directly to a trust fund, a highway trust fund. Some of it is siphoned off. There's about 20% for mass transit and things like that, and then there's other beautification and leaking storage tanks, that kind of thing. But really, it began as a very elegant compromise and something that very closely approached a user fee. But that's not the case anymore, as different vehicles, the range of mileage standards has increased greatly. It's not just the upper limit, but also the lower limit has not changed that much. There's a huge range in between what people are paying. And frankly, it's just not bringing in enough money anymore. There's been a lot of money that's had to be injected from the general fund, which, you know, comes from the rest of your taxes, and that's going to be a problem. Right now we're looking at 2014 for insolvency, but that's been periodically extended, but we'll see what happens.
So we drive more than ever before, though. So we're driving more. We're putting more miles on the highways. Isn't that the case since the highways were built?
Oh, certainly, certainly. It's just that the fuel standards, now that cars become more fuel efficient, and some cars don't burn gasoline at all,
right?
So we are traveling more miles for the same amount of money, and that's it's not sustainable.
What kind of estimates are out there about how high the gas tax would have to go to become sustainable?
Let's see. Well, the equivalent of the last raise in the gas tax, which was raised, I think, about 4 cents. To 18.4 was in 1993. The equivalent of that today to reach the same effect that it had, given interest and et cetera, would be 28 cents a gallon. But, you know, nobody's talking about putting additional taxes on, not at this point.
Which, you know, kind of brings you to that larger question. At 48,000 miles, the interstate system is the greatest, most expansive, most expensive public works project our country has ever built, you wrote. Some say that those days of pulling together for that greater good are over for a while, that we just can't muster what it's going to take to do what we have to do to maintain that system and perhaps build onto it or expand other modes of transportation. What about the folks that you talk to?
I think most of them agree with that. I mean, a point that your caller made, two points I think he really brought up pretty well, were the first that the marginal tax rate for people in the wealthiest sectors of society has fallen. They're not paying as much as they used to, and that results, of course, in less money. And the second is that transportation has become part of the culture wars, sort of inexplicably. I saw a prominent transportation expert stand up and decry bus lanes as socialism, and which, you know, frankly, is pretty ridiculous, however you want to look at it. But that division means I don't think there's going to be any solutions anytime soon. There's, you know, and I used to think that there were that it was inconceivable that the safety lieu, which is the current legislation that governs outlays for transportation, would expire without replacement, but now with the debt ceiling argument, I'm not so sure about that.
My guest is Zach Rosenberg. He's a journalist. He wrote an article for Car and Driver magazine last month about the decline of our interstate highway system and our inability to fund the repairs that are needed to keep it up to date. If you have a question or comment for us, we welcome it 614 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're also on Facebook, as you know, at the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Jackie Life. Coming up on the next On Point, gold rush fever. Frightened investors are buying up the yellow metal. Is this a good investment? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins later this afternoon at 1 o'clock here on 89.7 NPR News. 84 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly cloudy skies, a little more sunshine this afternoon, and a high reaching 91. Partly cloudy tonight, an overnight low of 72 degrees. Mostly sunny for Friday, a high of 91. There is a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm Friday afternoon and Friday evening.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Symphony, performing with the Ohio State Marching Band for the final weekend of this summer's Picnic with the Pops, topped off with fireworks Friday, July 29th and Saturday the 30th on the lawn of Chemical Abstract Service. PicnicWithThePops.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the era of the worn-out highway. That's how journalist Zach Rosenberg put it in his June article for Car and Driver magazine. The title of the article, The State of the Union's Roads. Thanks again for joining us, Zach.
Thank you, Ann.
Also with us now is David Ellis. David is a research scientist at the Texas Transportation Institute. He's also a visiting professor of urban planning in the College of Architecture at Texas A&M University. His most recent work is focused on transportation supply and demand and transportation tax policy. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me.
So what about the tax policy for transportation? What are our options at this point? There are things they're suggesting. Oh, such as vehicle miles traveled tax, National Infrastructure Bank. David, what do you hear? What are our options in the future?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we have to keep in mind. Number one, the problem generally, and this is the case in almost all states, is of such significance that there is no silver bullet out there. It's going to take a blend of a number of different strategies, one of which is eventually we're going to have to move away from the gas tax, which has served us well for low these many years. But as you and Zach were discussing just a couple of moments ago, for a couple of reasons, number one, fuel efficiency, as those and alternative fuel vehicles, as that increases over time, the amount of gasoline that we consume to drive X number of miles goes down, which is a wonderful thing from a energy point of view, from a strategic perspective for the country, but it has revenue consequences. And the other thing, of course, as I believe Zach mentioned just a while ago, it is a tax on a unit of fuel in this case. So every year, as construction prices go up, that 20 cents or 15 or 28 cents. Gasoline tax per gallon, whatever it happens to be in your particular state, mm-hmm. the amount of construction that buys decreases. So it's losing purchasing power two ways. So we're going to have to find a way to tax people on a use basis, which was what the fuel tax was originally intended to do and did very well for a long period of time. One thing perhaps is a VMT tax, actually just taxing you for the number of miles that you drive. People are very resistant to that right now. I see poll after poll where somewhere on the order of 20-25% of the people are in support of that. But we'll have to see if that changes over time. I think that's an educational process as much as anything else. The second issue is that we're going to have to do things like infrastructure banks, perhaps more toll roads, using debt, public-private partnerships, but we're also, I think, going to have to do a much better job of managing demand, getting more out of our system, the system that we already have. And I think we've done a historically poor job at that.
part of the problem or part of the dynamic is that the highway system wasn't necessarily, I mean, the purpose for it in the beginning wasn't altogether just about moving people around. It was about moving cars that we built in Detroit around the country. It was about other things than just people. Was it ever really fit for people, for the kind of number of people that are on it in the first place?
Well, yes and no. I mean, our country continues to grow, and the growth of the roadway system hasn't kept up at that same rate of growth, and so you get the inevitable congestion when demand begins to exceed supply of roadway. But you're absolutely right. The thing that gets lost in this discussion quite often is the importance of our transportation network relative to the economy of the United States, and how important, how vital being able to get goods to market and raw materials to manufacturing facilities, how important that is to be able to do that in a cost-effective basis so that the country can compete in a global market. If you look at the way the cost elements of most manufactured goods, you've got raw materials, you've got labor, and you've got transportation costs. Well, for most raw materials that are commodities, we compete in international markets, and those prices are set by the world demand. You look at the labor component. We are not going to work as cheap, nor do we want to work as cheap as people in other parts of the world will work. We have a higher standard of living. And so this efficiency issue becomes vitally important to our economic competitiveness, and part of that efficiency is being able to get goods to market as quickly and as efficiently as possible, because that becomes a major cost component in that finished good. And if we can't compete internationally in that regard, then it hurts our economy, hurts employment, hurts all of the things that from which we derive revenue that provides the things that we desire as a society.
You know, Zach Rosenberg, why was this topic, maybe it's obvious, but let's just say, why was this topic of interest to Car and Driver? Don't they usually write about cars and they're not what they drive on?
Well, sure, but of course cars have to drive on something, and you know, everybody has to commute to get to work and to get to school one way or another. As the subtitle of the article is, what's happening to the playground? You know, people who are into these sort of high-performance cars that Car and Driver usually writes about, they depend on the roads to be able to indulge in this hobby and to indulge in the things they really like to do. Without the roads, they don't get to do it.
Yeah, David Ellis, I bring that up because there are other interest groups that depend on the roads. There's truckers. There's an industry that you once worked for. You were a lobbyist at the Texas State House in Austin representing clients in the construction materials industry. It's not just about getting from point A to point B, is it?
You're exactly right. That's a critical part. Being able to commute back and forth to work is critical, and it has impacts far beyond just how much time we spend in the car, though that is very important. But you are right. There are so many other dimensions to this. As I mentioned, the whole movement of freight issue is critically important to our local, regional, state, and national economies. So there are a lot of different dimensions to this. There are also environmental considerations here, quite frankly. When you get in stop-and-go traffic, and the kind of we have in most of our major metropolitan areas, the amount of pollution generated from that versus the amount of pollution generated when traffic is flowing freely, we get much more pollution from stop-and-go traffic and vehicles stalled in traffic than we do when traffic is moving as it should. So there's a ton of different issues that are economic, environmental, social, you name it, that cut across a lot of different lines in our society.
Daryl in Brunswick, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning, Ann. I'm so glad I put you on this morning to see what you folks were talking about.
Oh, I am too.
It's something that I've been looking at and working on myself since about 2004 because I worked in the automotive industry. I'm now retired, and I'm only 53, so I'm not some old crazy guy or something, right?
I hope not.
Yeah. my comment, and it's I'll try to keep it as quick as possible. I have a couple comparisons. Right now, I believe we're in somebody else. I think you used the word stagnant or stagnation. Right now, I think we're between the Flintstones and the Jetsons. as far as our traffic at our roads, our cars. Not that I want to, or, you know, I'm not looking for the flying car, right? What I would like to see is, I think the money we could save by doing this, and again, somebody else mentioned socialism with the bus lanes, and the traffic that's stalled and, you know, parked in the, on the our roadways, right? Why is it that today your car can run a red light, or you can pull to the middle of an intersection and still make your turn even after the light's turned? I think it's off-the-shelf technology, as a matter of fact, right now, where your car can only go the maximum speed limit allowed. You cannot run red lights. The money we would save and from the insurance, we could put towards our highways. Now, I'm willing to pay for it. What I would like to see, I would like to see our highways divided between your heavy commercial traffic and your commuter traffic, moving in the direction of lightweight electric cars. That the way I see it, I'm envisioning a highway above the highway with its own ramps. And all your heavy trucks stay pretty much on the highway and then use smaller, lighter delivery vehicles. Look at the size of a truck that pulls into downtown Cleveland to drop off maybe four or five big bags of potatoes to, mm-hmm. you know, one of our nicer restaurants.
So you kind of want to reconceive the entire idea of what a highway is.
We need to move towards the Jetsons. And we have to pay for it now. Okay, maybe we can cut the debt and all that, but then we're going to leave our children and grandchildren stuck in traffic on roads that are completely obsolete.
David Ellis, are we closer, do you think, to the Jetsons or the Flintstones at this point?
Well, I think the gentleman makes a valid point. I think that we are closer to the Flintstones than the Jetsons, but here's the real value in the point that he makes. We have done a historically poor job, and I'm speaking here of my own discipline. My bachelor's degree was in economics, but my master's was in urban planning, and then my doctorate was in kind of a blend of the two. But so I'm criticizing my own planners here, but we have done a historically poor job, I think, in terms of transportation planning. What we do is we tend to understand where it was that we've been, and we plot that, and we figure out where we are now. We draw a line between them, and then we extend that line in the future and assume that the future is just going to be like the past except more of it. And that's not the way it's going to be. What we have to do now, I think, as a nation, is that we have to do a much better and much more creative job of planning our transportation system and focusing on what kind of demand is going to be out there 20 and 30 years from now. We need to sit down with the visionaries and the leaders, the men and women from business and industry and from across a lot of different disciplines, and say and ask them, what is your business going to be like? How are you going to do business 20 years from now, 25 years from now? How is your life going to be different in your business life? And we need to build a transportation system that meets that need. We need to do the same thing at a public level, rather, in terms of what their desires are and what it is they want out of a transportation system, as opposed to just assuming that our transportation system needs to just grow linearly with the population. Maybe we need to be smarter about how we use it. And I can give you a quick example. Here I am sitting in my office on campus at Texas A&M University. Frankly, I didn't need to come to work today to get everything I'm going to get done. I can work just as easily from home. It wasn't necessary for me to make that commute. Now, I live in a small town of about 70,000 people, so it doesn't matter much in terms of the traffic here. But you start thinking about, do we need to come to work 5 days a week, or are there some people who can make that commute 3 days a week, 4 days a week, perhaps 2 days a week? Can we reconfigure the way we live and work to get better, to use our system better? One way to improve traffic is to add capacity. Another is to reduce demand. And if we can reduce some demand during peak hours by altering the way we work and the way we live, that's as good in many instances as building another lane on a freeway, because we're using our system more efficiently. We need to look at those things and see how it is we're going to use our system in the future and make sure that we have one that will allow business to function efficiently, allow our country to compete economically and to employ the people and provide them with a good quality of life in the future. And I don't think we've done such a great job of that. I'll give you one quick example. In 1898, Great Planning Conference in New York City, and the major topic of conversation is an international planning conference, and they projected that by 1950, cities like London and New York would be 9 feet deep in horse manure. Well, the math that they did to arrive at that projection was spot on. What they missed was the advent of the automobile. They were just figuring that everybody by 1950 would still be riding horses and wagons. Well, that's the kind of planning that we've done in the past that's not going to suffice in the future.
We have from Michelle on Facebook. She says, how do we pay for our infrastructure? I think a fundraising campaign where they actually use the money for fixing these issues. My impression is the public is so tired of all the money going to other things and all of the posturing going on. The government as a brand has shot itself in the foot. Most of our money on transportation issues it's dedicated. It comes from the tax and it's supposed to be spent on roads, but it doesn't necessarily work that way. It's supposed to. And when it does come to certain transportation projects, you have to look at things like the Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska. And I was wondering what that has done to our perception of transportation funding. Zach Rosenberg, any thoughts about that?
Well, the perception, and I hear this from transportation professionals over and over again, is that the Gravina Island Bridge, what became known as the Bridge to Nowhere, was the worst thing to happen to transportation in the last 30 years. I certainly believe that's the case, but, you know, being stuck in traffic, I'm based here in Washington, D.C., where the average commuter spends about 90 minutes, I think, a day in stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic. And, you know, so while there's a perception that there is that traffic problem, that's also the case. I think the traffic gets a very bad rap.
An email from Mikey says, I have an 86-mile one-way commute, and I have a truck and a motorcycle. There are speed bumps and really bad potholes. It is tearing up my motorcycle. I pay for the tags for my bike and truck. Why can't the roads be fixed? I've reported them 3 times, and no one is fixing them in Ohio. That's another kind of a silent or an invisible consequence to many of us, that is the wear and tear on our cars and our motorcycles and our trucks. David Ellis?
No, you're absolutely right. It is a significant cost. And we did some calculations on that here in Texas in terms of cost to motorists at various levels of pavement performance. And the cost runs into the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars annually. It is a significant cost. Getting back to the issue about people, you know, paying taxes, but then wondering where the money goes, mm-hmm. and the bridges to nowhere and so on and so forth. I think one of the things that we can do in this country, both particularly at the state level, is to treat these issues the way a lot of our cities do when they do bond issues. When you issue bonds for a capital project, people, the city comes to the voters and says, if you will raise this tax, we're going to build this school. If you will raise this tax, we will build this road. Those kind of bond issues like that more often than not pass because people, they're able to judge what the tax increase is for and what they're going to get out of it. So many times what happens with our fuel tax is that we pay it at the pump, the money goes in, the money comes out, nobody actually knows where the money went, so on and so forth. I think if we approach this and we told people what it is they're going to get for the money, this is what we're going to do with your nickel increase. We're going to go do these 3 projects, these 4 projects. We're going to improve this road. We're going to do that. So that people can actually see what it is they're going to get for their money and base their decision whether to support that tax increase on those kind of decisions, people tend to be much more supportive of that approach than they do this kind of broad, trust me type of relationship with our tax system.
David Ellis, thanks for joining us today.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Lots
Appreciate
more to
it.
Talk about. I'm sure we'll continue the conversation in the future. David is a research scientist at the Texas Transportation Institute and a visiting professor of urban planning in the College of Architecture at Texas A&M University. Also, Zach Rosenberg, glad you could join us today.
Thank you.
Zach Rosenberg wrote an article for the June Car and Driver magazine. It's called The State of the Union's Roads. And we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you want to give that a look when we return, we're going to focus a little bit more on Ohio and talk a little bit about that idea of leasing the turnpike. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, girls discover their true beauty with Debbie Penzone, and then an open forum to discuss what you're talking about. Join us for Hour 2 of All Sides with Ann Fisher, beginning at 11.
Connect Ohio wants to get every citizen online with free computer classes in our community. Find a job, get a degree, save time and money, and keep up with family and friends. Call 1-855-NOW-I-CAN to see what you can do with broadband. That's 1-855-NOW-I-CAN.
ArtZine is WOSU Public Media's magazine on the web. At WOSU.org/ArtZine, read articles about the latest arts and culture news in Columbus. ArtZine also features video stories highlighting some of the best artists in Central Ohio. Visit WOSU.org/ArtZine to find out more. Sunny skies today and a few clouds, a high of 91, partly cloudy tonight, a low of 72. Mostly sunny for Friday with a chance of a pop-up thunderstorm and a high of 91. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about our nation's highways and bridges. The interstate system we started building 50 years ago is wearing out. And given our current state of affairs and the way we generate transportation revenue, we can't afford to fix them. We're going to turn the conversation closer to home now with Gene Krebs. Gene is Senior Director of Government Affairs and Policy at the Greater Ohio Policy Center. Welcome to the show, Gene.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also joining us to talk about the plan to lease the Ohio Turnpike is Deputy Mayor of Operations for the City of Toledo, Steve Hurwat. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you, Ann. Thanks for having me on.
If you have a question or comment for us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're specifically interested at this point in talking a little bit more about Ohio, talking about whether or not to lease the Turnpike in Northern Ohio. So give us a call if you have a question or comment about that. Let's talk about the larger funding issue for a moment, Gene, in Ohio and how we fund our highways. Mostly it's improvement. There isn't a lot of new stuff going in anymore.
Well, unfortunately, though, the state of Ohio has, over past history, been adding on way too many additional lane miles, and we need to be instead looking more at preservation.
You mean adding on?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we need to look at that. And one of our biggest hopes, and I will give the listeners out there are probably very depressed right now from hearing the previous experts. One small ray of hope. I've used up all my political chits, and since Greater Ohio has no PAC, we don't make campaign donations, we don't have a whole lot. But the Ohio Department of Transportation is now being required to do a performance audit being performed by the Auditor of State. Virginia did a very similar audit. Virginia's VDOT's very similar to ours in size, $600 million a year of immediate ongoing savings. So we think that there's some – this goes to the issue of can we do some structural reforms to make the money we currently have stretch further. Right now we have about 28 cents per gallon of gasoline tax in Ohio. The previous folks were exactly correct. Here's another way to think about it. If we are experiencing a 3% decline in gas tax revenue and a 4% core inflator, that's 7% percentage loss of purchasing power for ODOT. That translates into 2 pennies of gasoline tax. So in other words, for us to maintain status quo here in Ohio, we'd have to increase the gas tax 2 pennies a year forever. No one wants to do that, and that's not sustainable financially or politically. So we have to come up with a better way to move people and goods in a more, what I would call a more agnostic manner. So you're not paying attention to an ideology of highways is the only way. What is the best way to move people and goods at all points in time? We think that's the most cost-effective way to handle this issue.
But we have this system out there
right.
that has to be maintained. I asked the question earlier, and I pretty much knew the answer. No, of course we're not going to shut down parts of the interstate, but how do you buoy that system and also develop other systems? As you know, the governor of Ohio, John Kasich, sent back hundreds of millions of dollars in funding for mass transit in Ohio for trains.
I'll give you two very practical things you can do. One, there's been a whole lot of controversy about the I-70-71 split here in Columbus, a $1.5 billion project. The amount of money we get for the gas tax each year is $1.8 billion. So this is essentially a whole year's revenue stream going to one project. If we could, under then-Governor Voinovich, he passed an executive order saying that state workers were granted flex time. They could come and leave, you know, on a more flexible basis as long as they did the 40 hours.
To save money.
It was at the request of MRPC, and it had to do with both capacity and also with air quality. A Strickland administration, after about 6 months, abolished that. Okay. And so if we could, that's one very small thing that a previous listener has
to take the pressure off the roads at any one
right.
time.
If you could move 10 to 20,000 people, you know, a day off the I-70-71 split and put them into other things. So if you could give me, for example, $600 million to establish some other alternative means of getting those folks around Central Ohio, I could save the citizens $900 million.
But back when George Voinovich was governor of the state of Ohio, there were a lot more state employees. There were a lot more people to go around. Flex time always works. Speaking for my own department, works a lot better when there are more people. When you don't, hey, it's very brittle.
Right.
If you don't, and Strickland did that because there weren't enough people around to even answer the phones.
Right. But the reason is that this has a huge impact on, and it's all the everybody who does the servicing of it. And it's also for the listeners out there, they're probably thinking, here we are, deja vu all over again. This conversation, and Greater Ohio has been maintaining now for 5 years that ODOT is in severe fiscal trouble. And I will give some credit yesterday that in a 25-minute special presentation at the Columbus Metropolitan Club, Director Jerry Ray spent 5 minutes discussing their fiscal, you know, doom coming. I think it should have been 25 minutes, a 30-minute program talking about their pending fiscal collapse. But we need to get people out there talking about it, realizing – because it mirrors the discussion we're having at the federal level too. It's exactly the same thing. And you need to start dealing with it and dealing with it now in an intelligent manner. So the ray of hope, there will be a state – there will be an audit of the Ohio Department of Transportation.
Steve Hurwat, Deputy Mayor of Operations for Toledo. The city of Toledo, specifically Mayor Mike Bell, has said he supports the governor's proposal to perhaps lease the Ohio Turnpike. What are the benefits of doing something like that for the state and for Toledo?
The benefits are that, as Mr. Krebs has indicated, there's no appetite in Ohio to raise the gas tax. ODOT is facing some severe funding constraints. It's unclear on the federal level as to what level of federal funding will be provided in the next transportation bill. So we see the leasing of the turnpike as a mechanism to provide some badly needed infrastructure improvements in Northwest Ohio in particular. Two projects that are very important to us are the I-475 interchange right in Toledo, which is next to a 100-acre industrial site that we're hoping to redevelop. South of us in Wood County, there's a desperate need to widen I-75 from Perrysburg south to North Baltimore, where CSX has just built a multi-million-dollar intermodal train facility so that we can get containers from the Port of Toledo, which is an international port, on trucks and get them down to rail. The dredging of the Maumee River and the Maumee Bay and the Port of Toledo are important in order for us to continue to get ocean-going vessels and in and out of Toledo. These are all projects that can be funded with the proceeds from the Turnpike, and that's why Mayor Bell has taken the position that he is supporting the notion of leasing the Turnpike.
And the Jerry Ray, the Director of Transportation for the state of Ohio, has said, yeah, you know, this will give us more money to spend on transportation infrastructure. But the governor said this week that he couldn't promise to use the revenue from the sale or from the lease on highways only, that it could go to the general revenue fund just to operate state government.
We understand that, and certainly one of the conditions of the mayor's support is that we would expect that money from the Turnpike lease would be used to fund the type of project that I've just described. The governor was in Toledo on Monday and met with a number of local elected representatives. We heard our colleagues over in Sandusky County complain about the fact, rightfully so, that they have four township roads that go over the Turnpike that they have to close because the Turnpike won't properly maintain the bridges to provide access to those roads. We also heard a county commissioner from Defiance County to the southwest of us talk about what's happening there. Indiana is raiding companies from Northwest Ohio because of the fact they use the money from their Turnpike lease they're giving free land at interchanges to companies who will move from Northwest Ohio to relocate from Indiana. We need to be in a position to compete economically. As I'm talking to you today, I'm literally 55 miles away from the Indiana line. The Indiana Turnpike was leased for $3.8 billion. Now, they made some mistakes that we can't repeat here in Ohio. They took a total upfront cash deal so that they're not sharing in the ongoing revenue. The tolls have almost doubled on the Indiana Turnpike since the private concern took over, and the state of Indiana agreed that they would not improve any of the parallel routes. Those were all mistakes that the governor and Director Rayer committed not to repeat here in Ohio.
A cost, an economic cost, though, in Indiana has been the tolls themselves. They've doubled in 5 years since the state leased its toll roads. Gene Krebs, are there other... You know, is leasing always good, or does it depend?
Unfortunately, I'll do my best imitation of an economist here and say it does depend. And I'll give you a reason why we're having to look at this so strongly. After the Minnesota Bridge collapsed, they did polling on a nickel gas tax increase solely to fund the repair of bridges. It could only gain 48% of approval rating 2 weeks after that bridge collapsed. The concern I have with the Turnpike is that the Turnpike, and indeed that whole structure it represents, is old technology. And I would be hesitant to have the state of Ohio make all the investments from the proceeds of that lease, monetization, however you want to frame it, back into old technology. Some of it is going to have to go into new technology, coming up with the most effective way to move people and goods in a cost-effective and safe manner, which may mean highways, it may mean rail, it may mean barge, it may mean airport, and it may mean transit or even sidewalks. So you have to come up with a way to figure out how we do it in the most cost-effective fashion, because Bobby and Betty Buckeye are running out of patience.
Wayne in New Albany, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Ann. I often drive from Columbus to South Bend, and in the last 5 years, I saw increased traffic on U.S. 30, which is south of the Indiana Toll Road. And over the years, I've heard more and more stories about improperly maintained roads on the toll road, increased fees, and because of that, I've seen increased semi-traffic on U.S. 30, which is a free highway. My concern is that U.S. 30 becomes in a poor shape as the Indiana Toll Road is, and the last 5 years, frankly, have not been an effective way to get revenue for the state of Indiana by leasing that toll road.
Steve Hurwat, are you concerned? And by the way, thank you very much, Wayne, for that call. Steve Hurwat, are you concerned that as you know, toll increases, which probably will occur if the toll road is leased, as it drives some people, pushes some people off the toll road onto local roads, who's going to maintain those and who's going to manage the extra traffic from, you know, the wear and tear from that? Are you concerned?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we saw that firsthand here in Northwest Ohio. A few years back, the Ohio Turnpike Commission dramatically raised the tolls for trucks. It drove the trucks off the turnpike onto parallel routes such as US 20, which is an east-west route, which runs from Toledo to Indiana and through northern Indiana. Much of that's a two-lane roadway, so you don't want to have increased semi-traffic there. So there has to be reasonable controls on any increases in tolls so that you don't defeat the purpose of leasing the turnpike and forcing trucks onto local roads. That's why it's important for us not to repeat the mistake they made in Indiana, where they cannot improve the parallel routes because it's forbidden based on the terms of their turnpike lease. But the governor has proposed it would not preclude any improvements or ongoing maintenance of the parallel routes in Ohio.
Gene Krebs, any final thoughts? We're running out of time.
Yeah. One cautionary note. I know they've mentioned is they take the turnpike money and use that to go ahead and increase capacity on 75 in Wood County. Traditionally, and even Director Ray acknowledged this yesterday in his presentation, is that if you increase capacity, the capacity will fill up very, very quickly and you're back to where you are. In other words, we need to take a totally different look at this and get off of our addiction.
Gene Krebs, he's Senior Director of Government Affairs and Policy at the Greater Ohio Policy Center. Gene, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Also, Steve Hurwat. Steve is Deputy Mayor of Operations for the City of Toledo. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
And thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.